Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. How ready are we for a big earthquake? We held a giant drill this summer, the Cascade Rising Earthquake Response Drill, to test our region's response to power blackouts and damaged roads and bridges, and we failed, according to a draft report card. Washington State is unprepared for a major earthquake. From the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network, Bill Steele tells you the ways we're not prepared.
Oh, boy, there's a lot of them. First of all, just walking around here through the U District or downtown, we see a lot of unreinforced masonry buildings still up, and they pose a real hazard for the people on the sidewalk and the folks in the buildings because we know they fail pretty readily under strong shaking conditions. So we'd really like to see a program to retrofit those buildings or take them down and build them, come back with a much better structure, because even retrofitted, they're never going to be as good as a modern building.
Okay. Unreinforced masonry, bad. What else did we do badly in this Cascade?
Well, I think we've chosen to put our head in the sand, so to speak, on the beach. We haven't really looked at, in a realistic way, the tsunami threat to our coastal communities. I think there have been a small group that has been working very hard the last almost 15, 20 years now to try to raise awareness and plan for that eventual tsunami. And we're beginning to see headway now. The real exciting thing for me this June is the Acosta School District did a ribbon cutting on the first vertical evacuation building in the entire country at an elementary school that was built with local tax dollars to save the lives of the kids and the local community in the event of a tsunami.
Okay, we did something right. Otherwise, our head is in the sand on the beach. Why? Why aren't we better prepared?
It costs a lot of money.
Rats.
We have a lot of infrastructure, and we have a lot of immediate needs. We're trying to fund all-day kindergarten and try to keep the class sizes reasonable and fund K-12 education. We want our bridges strong. That's very expensive. And replacing these buildings costs a lot of money. And so sometimes what happens if you don't have all those resources, you tend to do nothing. And what we're hoping to see in future from this Cascadia Rising exercises and others, motivation to kind of have a long-term plan to build resilience in the state of Washington and Oregon, and so that when this earthquake eventually does occur, we're in much better shape to deal with it.
Well, we know getting ready for an earthquake is expensive. We have agencies to do this kind of thing. I don't understand why the lack of preparedness is because it's expensive. That's just a bill we've decided to pay, isn't it?
Well, not really, because we really don't have the resources to do everything, quickly. And there are other priorities folks have that. They want that lane to help reduce traffic congestion. They want that new bridge that is needed to get people across Lake Washington. There are a lot of other priorities that are very expensive. So the earthquake mitigation kind of drops down a little. Now, WashDOT has done a lot of retrofitting of bridges, but what that's done primarily is link the bridge decks together and do some strengthening of the bridge structure itself, but not necessarily the bridge-soil interaction or the abutments. So it's improved things, but there's still very vulnerable transportation links in our region and in our city where I-5 run could have some catastrophic failures.
One of the recommendations from the report is that people stock up on 2 weeks' worth of food instead of just 3 days. How realistic is that?
Well, I think it depends somewhat on your condition. I think it's a good target. You want a deeper pantry if you can afford it. If you're in an apartment, you might have trouble finding the shelf space for 2 weeks.
Right.
And so I think having, a few, if even you had the 3 days to a week of food put aside, you can stretch that out. We don't starve to death instantly, and we have some fat of the land to live off of, most of us. So, we're not going to starve. We might be a little uncomfortable, but if you have 3 days worth of food and the disaster ends up taking 2 weeks before you get help, you'll make it. The water is harder. And even though you may not be able to put water aside for 2 weeks in your small place, you could put enough for a few days and again have a filter that could make water potable for your use and to refill those jugs as the disaster progresses. So you don't necessarily have to have all the water on hand immediately, but have some means of getting it.
You're a seismologist. What's your house like for preparedness? What you got?
I have a pantry in the basement, and it's pretty deep. I have enough food there, and probably I think we have 12 gallons of water total in the house. We probably do some more of that, but I do have a good filter, and we have really good cooperative relationships with all of our neighbors. So when we know where the generator is in our neighborhood, we know where the water filters are in the neighborhood, we know where the medical people are in our neighborhood, and we talk together regularly. So that's going to be an important asset for my family, is our neighbors when the disaster occurs.
The neighborhood preparedness, that's important. Right? Really, your neighbors are going to be a huge part of this. We talk about our own food and water, but
they're going to be the fire department, the police, the medical squad. I mean, we could be islands. You know, our neighborhoods are islands, and we have tremendous resources and intelligent people and wonderful folks living in our neighborhood. If we knew where they were and what their capabilities are, we could utilize that to really get by a lot better.
Okay, bottom line for those just joining us, we got this report out of our earthquake drill, and what should we take away from it, Bill?
That right now we're underprepared for a big earthquake, for a magnitude 9 Cascadia or a magnitude 6 Seattle fault or even another Nisqually earthquake. We could do more to be better prepared for that. So we don't know when these are going to occur next. Individually, the chance of a big earthquake on any one fault is not huge for a 50-year period, 15% for a magnitude 9 on the Cascadia subduction zone, 15% for a big crustal fault breaking in the Puget Sound area, and at like an 83, 84% chance of a big deep earthquake somewhere in the Puget Sound area. But put together, we have a substantial hazard, and I'll be surprised if in your lifetime we don't have another big earthquake.
Bill Steele with the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network at the University of Washington telling you to stock up and get to know your neighbors now, before the quake, now. We're tweeting out a link to a website, too, that will help you prepare, so follow us at KUOW. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. In other news today, what a weird Seahawks game last night, a 6-6 tie that ended in overtime after two missed field goals that kickers don't usually miss. We called Stefan Fatsis from the Hang Up and Listen podcast because he once tried to be an NFL kicker. He wrote a book about it called A Few Seconds of Panic. Stefan says he really felt it when that Arizona kicker missed the first overtime field goal.
He hit the upright, doinked it straight off of the left upright. And there's nothing more painful for me than watching a kicker fail, because the impression of the kicker, the image of the kicker, is that he is this little loser that trots out there with a clean uniform and does what he does, and it looks really easy.
You do one thing. Nobody's even tackling you.
Right. It's the old, you had one job.
Yeah.
You had one job.
Yes.
It's a hard job, and it is an erratic job, no matter how consistent you are, no matter how strong you are. And look, the guys that end up kicking in the NFL are the very best at this very narrow task. But a lot of things can go wrong in kicks. And as we saw in the game last night, the Seattle linebacker leaped over the center and blocked a kick earlier in the game.
Yep.
And then disrupted the next kick in the overtime. But whenever a kicker misses, there really are no excuses, because it is a repetitive act. It is like striking a golf ball. You do this thousands and thousands of times so that nothing, not the 75,000 fans, not the onrushing Giants, not a slightly off-kilter snap or hold or any other distraction, weather, turf, anything else that can interrupt the flow of the game, you're supposed to not be affected by anything. But kickers are human. Things come off of your foot a quarter of an inch one way or another, and it's going to disrupt the flight of the ball, and that's what happened with that kick. He pulled it a little bit to the left, and it struck the goalpost.
The Seahawks kicker, Steven Hauschka, missed his overtime kick 28 yards out, and the coaches of the two teams had very opposite reactions. This is our coach, Pete Carroll, gum-snapping Pete Carroll. He says, he's been making kicks for us for years. I love him, and he's our guy. The Cardinals coach said about his kicker, they say in high school, baby, you get paid to make it. Who's right?
Yeah, coaches are kind of jerks. I give Pete Carroll a lot of credit because he has instilled a much more humane environment in that team, at least from what I've been able to glean from reading about the Seahawks over the last few years. So think of Pete Carroll. You can have whatever opinion you want about Pete Carroll, but he's definitely done that with this team. He understands that this is a game played by human beings, and that in order to get these human beings to achieve a higher level, you have to have some sort of humanity in dealing with them. They are grown men. They do make mistakes. And that the only way to evaluate kickers is over the long time. Small sample size means nothing in kicking. And what you see in the NFL now is that kickers have career marks of 85, 90%, 90-plus percent. But the scrutiny doesn't change. So credit to Pete Carroll. The one thing I learned in spending a summer inside an NFL team is that the element that needs to be increased to make these players more effective and to make them feel that they are more responsible and not just moving parts is an appreciation for their maturity and their humanity and their fallibility. And I've been waiting 10 years to see more coaches have a better appreciation for what athletes go through and how they sacrifice their bodies and their brains to play the sport.
Final question, Stefan. Should we get rid of the tie game in the NFL?
Oh, no. We love tie games. I was giddy last night. When I tuned in at 3-3 after looking on Twitter and seeing it was a tie score, the first thing I did was go see when the last time there was a 3-3 tie game, and you can do that on profootballreference.com. 1937 was the last time. And then after it was 3-3 and it was clear this was going to overtime, I was really hoping for a 5-3 final. That would have been a safety.
Yes.
The last time there was one of those was 1925. It was the only time in NFL history. And then it got to 6-3, and I checked that. And then 6-6, there have only been two other 6-6, four field goal games in the history of the NFL. The last one was in 1972, and now all three of them have involved the Cardinals. I love that sort of esoteric nonsense.
Why would anybody love a tie?
You know, the ties happen in life. We have to accept the outcome and move on. Someone doesn't always win. I'm a soccer fan because there are ties, except in the World Cup, in the elimination rounds, and in tournaments like that. But the idea of a tie is ingrained in sports, in most of our sports, particularly in football. We do everything, we've done everything in the last X decades to eliminate uncertainty in sports. The tie is the embodiment that life doesn't always work out for one team or the other, that there are ambiguous outcomes, and we should embrace those ambiguous outcomes. I say keep the tie.
Stefan Fatsis says he will accept the results of this game.
As ugly as they were.
Yes. Peaceful transition. Stefan Fatsis, Slate's Hang Up and Listen podcast, and author of the book about trying to make it as an NFL kicker, A Few Seconds of Panic. Stefan, thanks for that.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein will not be getting out the vote today in Seattle and Olympia. Her campaign says she's recovering from pneumonia. They're sending her campaign manager instead. Both of those rallies are still on. Now, let's say you prefer Jill Stein to both the Republican and the Democratic nominee, yet you know she's not going to win. Is a Green Party vote a statement or a waste? Seattle City Council member Kshama Sawant will be on stage at those Green Party rallies. She wants you to vote green and vote Stein for president. Nation magazine contributor Joshua Holland says, no, don't throw away your vote. He says the Green Party is ineffective.
And it's an ineffective party because it's taken a strategy of devoting a lot of its resources to presidential elections. Quixotic runs for president. Whereas I think that if you're going to be an effective third party, the way to do it is to build from the bottom up, run for local offices. I would point to how much Kshama Sawant has accomplished in the city council in Seattle. The Green Party office holders at the local level has declined by 25% since 2003. So I think that they're going in the opposite direction by putting an overwhelming share of their resources into getting on the ballot for these presidential campaigns.
City Council member Sawant, so Joshua is saying that the Green Party is the wrong vessel, ineffective, quixotic. What do you say? You're supporting a vote for Jill Stein.
I would say that this is not about the Green Party. In my mind, and in the minds of socialist alternative, my activist organization that I work with, who supported Bernie in the primary, who then urged Bernie Sanders to run as an independent through November, And then because he failed to do that, we have endorsed Jill Stein. What's happening this year is not about the Green Party. What's
happening
this year?
Well, then why not vote for there's a Socialist Workers Party on the ballot. Why not vote for
them? I'm glad you asked that question, Bill, because that's an important one, understanding, because this is a question of strategy. It is not a question of a fetish about any party. It's a question of strategy. And I think the question for progressives should be, what is the most effective way of breaking the stranglehold of Wall Street and the billionaire class?
That's the question. So what makes you think a Green Party vote is the most effective way? Because Joshua is saying it's not.
Well, it's ineffective. Because Joshua is talking about something that the vast majority of America is not thinking about. The vast majority of America is thinking about, how do we break out of this corporate stranglehold?
I hear quite a bit that, you know, a vote for the Green Party is it sends a message to the establishment, to those in power. This is the most faulty of all the arguments. In 2012, 42% of the electorate just stayed home. Jill Stein got 0.36% of the electorate. It's a rounding error in terms of the lack of the people who do not vote for one of the major parties. And again, we hear about that this is about rejecting the Democratic Party, and very little defense of the Green Party, which, first of all, has adopted a scorched earth attack against Democrats. They are running a very dishonest campaign. You could go to Jill Stein's website. You'll see that claims that Barack Obama banned the morning after pill. She claims that the 2009 stimulus was overwhelmingly directed at tax cuts for the wealthy. That's false. And this is not constructive. I believe that you need to push Democrats from the left. And this kind of idea that you throw everything at the wall and see what sticks is an ineffective strategy. And it marks the ineffective nature of this party as a rule.
Councilmember Samwat, we're talking about what's effective. Both of you are. What is your evidence that a Green Party vote would be, as you said, strategic, effective? You said you're all about strategy. This is not a protest vote to you.
I don't mean that it's a strategy in the sense that I have any illusion that she's going to win.
Yes.
But what I'm saying is that if we are to look at what is going to really turn things around for the vast majority of America that is aching, that is suffering right now, and even at the time that it is the wealthiest in the very history of humanity, I think if we're seriously thinking about it, then we have to acknowledge, as does a lot of America, you know, 60% of Americans polled are saying that they want a new party because they have seen that decade after decade, their interests are being betrayed as long as you stay within this framework of Republicans and Democrats. And I think that you cannot get any real explanations of what is the way forward as long as we are stuck with this idea of looking at every presidential election in its own snapshot. I mean, Joshua mentioned the 2012 election where most electorates stayed home, but his analysis of why that happened is completely wrong. The reason the 2012 election had a much lower voter turnout than 2008, if you all recall, Bill, you know, Obama had a historic voter turnout of a Latino community, the Black community, women, and the LGBTQ community. The reason they turned out in such big numbers was because they had all pinned their hopes on yet another round of Democratic Party politicianeering. And this is not a debate about Obama's secret intentions. It's a question of whether if you run as the major party candidate, can you deliver on your promises?
Joshua, you have written that the Democrats and Republicans have separated, and the Democrats are markedly more progressive now in contrast to the past. What's your evidence of that?
Well, you can look at a wide variety of evidence. Political scientists use a metric called DW-nominate, which actually measures the relative position of members of Congress according to their voting records. It's a fundamentally flawed argument that there's no difference or that Trump is just as bad as Clinton. This is what we're hearing from Jill Stein this cycle. The reality is that most members of the progressive movement have dedicated themselves to pushing the Democratic Party to the left. We have marginalized the idea of Social Security reform. We have marginalized a lot of the right-wing economic claptrap that was ascendant in the 1990s. We worked hard to do that. And by saying that there's no difference, that we haven't made any progress, it's an insult to a lot of progressives who have done a lot of hard work on these issues.
So Shama Sawant, this is an important question. He's making the case that you do have a choice. It's an important choice. The Democrats are getting progressive work done, and that's the place to put the power of your ballot. What's your evidence to the contrary?
Well, first of all, I think we should not build up strawmen. I think we are all completely agreed that not only are Trump and Clinton not the same in any way.
That's not a strawman. Jill Stein regularly says that Hillary Clinton is more dangerous than, that may be more dangerous than Donald Trump. Folks can look that up. She says it regularly on The Stump.
Okay, and the two of you are agreed that you don't want Trump in office.
Yes,
but if worse than Clinton. But go on.
It's Jill Stein who's saying that.
I don't agree that they are the same, and I don't think that it's going to be a productive conversation if we just get stuck there, because that's not true. And we also don't agree that the Republicans and Democrats are the same. But the problem is that the Democratic Party has not really provided a progressive alternative away from the Wall Street agenda, away from right-wing demagoguery. And actually, the opposite has happened. They have, because they have this approach of developing, trying to develop a common ground with the right wing, rather than building the power of their social base, rather than empowering social movements, which is the way we have operated in Seattle. Socialist alternative does not operate in some sort of stratosphere. The reason, the very reason we won our election was not because the Democratic Party establishment supported us, but they actually opposed us with every tool that they had in their toolbox. The reason we won was because we empowered ordinary working people, and we based ourselves in social movements like the Fight for 15, and we won those victories. And my point is that a vote for the most known left-wing alternative is an investment. It's an investment in building the prospects for an independent party of the 91%.
But haven't we had third-party votes? We've had Ralph Nader. We've had other. We had Ross Perot. Very different. But we've had third-party votes.
Advocate for
Ross
Perot.
I realize that. But the Green Party hasn't grown. It's got fewer candidates than
I don't imagine that it's going to happen in a day. What I'm saying is that investing in a left-wing alternative this year will provide us a little bit of a down payment for the future. But I don't think that you can do that just by voting for Jill Stein. You have to really build social movements on the ground that are tied to building an independent party.
Okay, Joshua, what about just as a down payment? Jill Stein now, more later.
Well, when I've spoken with Kishama in the past, she's talked about what she's done at the local level, which is work very closely with social movements. It's an inside-outside strategy. I would like to see the Greens focusing on winning more offices in city councils, winning more school board offices, more local elected offices. This is not what they do. This is not what they do. You can invest in the Green Party. They're going to take your investment and spend it on getting ballot access for a quixotic presidential campaign in 2020. They're not going to build their party from the grassroots up. The only appeal of the Green Party is that they're not Democrats, right? But that's not enough to invest your time and energy. If you go to a Green Party meeting, what are you going to see? You're not going to see any critique of the right. You're going to see a bunch of mostly white people proving to each other who is the most ideologically pure. That's what you're going to see. So it's not a down payment in any kind of coherent strategy to build a grassroots progressive movement. It is a waste of your vote. Whether Jill Stein gets 0.36% as she did in 2012, or whether she gets four times that much and, you know, whatever that is, 2%, 1.4%, it makes no difference. It makes no difference. They're contracting as a party at the local level, and they're putting all their resources into promoting Jill Stein, who is doing these scorched earth attacks on the Democrats, very dishonest attacks. And I don't see how that helps the progressive movement in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, last word, Shama Samat.
Well, you know, Bernie Sanders ran as a socialist in America. America is like the belly of the capitalist beast. He ran as a socialist, and he called for a political revolution against the billionaire class. And the heartland of America rose in response to that call and said, yes, that is what we want. All of those progressive Americans, who many of whom are actually, I know, are going to vote for Clinton. I completely understand that. I'm compassionate to that, because they are trying to keep Trump out. But the reality is that they are not voting for Clinton out of any enthusiasm for her, because even they know that this is not working anymore. But right now, I want to keep Trump out. And those are the people I am speaking to. And I know that most of your listeners, Bill, will fall into something along that spectrum where they're voting for Clinton, but they know something's wrong fundamentally in this two-party stranglehold. And I think if we are to seriously provide a way for the future, we have to break out of that.
Shama Sawant, a member of the Seattle City Council, talking with Joshua Holland, a contributor to The Nation magazine and host of Politics and Reality Radio. You can read their opposing articles side by side in The Nation about the merits of voting for Jill Stein, thenation.com. We're tweeting out a link to those articles, too, so join us at KUOW. The Green Party will rally voters tonight at Kane Hall on the University of Washington campus, 7 o'clock, with the candidate herself, Jill Stein, down recovering from pneumonia. And her campaign manager will be there instead, as will Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant. Now, there's more to say about this presidential election today. How far down the ballot could a Democratic victory go? Who are the log cabin Republicans endorsing? And what are the obstacles to voting if you're one of 35 million voting-age Americans who has a disability? You'll learn about all of that this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. It's The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. There's a Northwest bird known for the dazzling displays they make as they funnel into chimneys for the night. The problem is old chimneys are getting torn down. So EarthFix reporter Cassandra Profita says people are finding other ways to help the bird known as the Vox's Swift.
This is genuine Vox's Swift guano, a.k.a. Swift poop.
Larry Schwitters is putting a lot of hope into a 5-gallon bucket of bird poop. It's one of the ways he plans to lure thousands of swifts into his homemade version of the chimneys they use as a nightly roost.
The idea is we throw it in the chimney in the bottom, and it's got an odor, supposedly, that the swifts can smell. And if they fly over it and take a sniff, they'll think, hey, swifts have used this before. This is a good one. You can smell it.
Of course, the swifts have never seen a chimney like this before. Behind him, a 6-foot section of concrete sewer pipe dangles from a crane. Slowly, it's being lifted onto a vertical stack of pipes coming out of the ground at a grassy park in Albany.
This is like a Tinker Toy project. This is Legos all over again.
Jim Fairchild with the Audubon Society of Corvallis points out the ridges inside the pipes, a special feature they added just for swifts.
You usually don't see this in big pipe sections, but here the birds can hang on with their little claws.
Swifts would naturally roost in hollow, old-growth tree trunks. But most of those were wiped out by logging. So the swifts started using old chimneys instead. Thousands of them can roost together in the brick-and-mortar chimneys on old school and hospital buildings.
As they somehow collectively decide this is the place to be for tonight, they start forming into a funnel, and then birds will just start dropping faster and faster out of this funnel. What triggers that? How they don't bump into each other? It's just an amazing phenomenon.
Inside, they cling to the walls and huddle together to stay warm. But now, Schwitter says, their chimneys are disappearing too.
The chimneys that work, all of them had to be built before World War II. 1940-ish, fire codes changed and they had to put in a liner.
Newer chimneys are smooth inside, so the birds have nothing to hold on to.
So the ones that are being used now are old and crumbly and ready to fall down.
Old chimneys aren't likely to survive a big earthquake, so many are being torn down. In Albany, the city recently demolished an old firehouse chimney where 20,000 swifts were known to roost in the spring. Schwitters and other bird advocates found a nearby park where they could test out a replacement.
There's no guarantees this is going to work. This is an experiment. What we think we need to do is we need to get these birds, the first migration, if they come through, that they don't have a roost site. That's why we're in a hurry.
Audubon Society board member Will Wright saw what happened after a swift chimney was demolished in Ellensburg, Washington.
It was so sad. The next year, the swifts came back and they circled the site for hours.
Without old chimneys, it's unclear where the swifts will go to roost. The total number of Vox's swifts on the West Coast has been dropping. Advocates worry a lack of roost sites may be to blame. For weeks after the new roost is complete, Audubon volunteers watch the sky at dusk and wait.
There's probably 15 birds I can see right now, just a few blocks away.
Through binoculars, Fairchild spots the birds flying around their old roost site.
There are swifts over the old fire station. They're starting to gather. They're going, hey, what's happening? There's no roost here.
Even with the birds in view, the question remains. How to get the swifts to use their new birdhouse? They've got the bird poop and one other trick that might bring them in. A recording of swift calls played through a loudspeaker.
We have half a dozen tracks, and let's turn up the sound.
He'd love to see thousands of birds come to roost here, like they did at the firehouse chimney. So far, the birds have flown by the new roost, but they haven't gone in. Fairchild says he's prepared to wait. If it works, advocates plan to build a whole lot more of these concrete cylinders along the birds' migration between Canada and Mexico. I'm Cassandra Profita reporting.
Homes are expensive in the Puget Sound area. Foreign buyers might be driving up prices. Well, our neighbors in Vancouver, BC have some experience with this, and they reacted by putting a tax on real estate purchases by non-Canadian buyers. Should we do that here? Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton says his readers are in favor. Hi, John.
Hi, Bill.
Readers like the idea of a tax?
Well, the very unscientific poll that I did and what I've heard from in emails from readers is that they would like to slap a tax on foreign real estate buying here in Seattle.
So let's look north. Vancouver Metro has had this for a few months. How's it working up there?
Well, it appears to have slowed down foreign buying quite a bit. The downside is that the attention of buyers, especially from China, has shifted here.
Yes. Now, this could be good or bad news depending on where you sit. Homeowners in the Seattle area have got to be pretty happy right now.
Well, this is the contradiction of our very fine wine here in Seattle, is that we hear a lot about how expensive house prices are. But that is a boon for a lot of people who actually own property. They're seeing their prime asset rise in value. Now, some, of course, have trouble paying the taxes. But on the other hand, it's becoming less affordable, especially in the city, not in the metro area, but in the city.
So in the Vancouver area, putting this 15% property transfer tax for real estate purchases, if you're not Canadian, that has been so effective that they're looking to buy here instead?
That is the anecdotal evidence, certainly. We don't have hard evidence, but anecdotally and from a lot of places, we hear that the Chinese money is headed here and to a lesser degree to Toronto.
Why are Chinese buyers so interested in the Pacific Northwest?
For a lot of reasons. Chinese have a lot of money saved as opposed to Americans. They want to be in a safe haven, a country that has a very high quality of life and has the rule of law and maybe a little bit out of the reach of the Communist Party. They like our region. And in some cases, you have then very wealthy Chinese, either individuals or these murky LLCs that have a lot of dollars that they want to park somewhere where they can get a higher yield. And so in Vancouver, for instance, you had a lot of buying of properties where they were just sitting empty. I don't know that that is happening here so much. There's a lot of interest on the east side.
Right, especially on the east side. What do you think, then? Should some of your readers like the idea? Do you think a foreign buyer tax should happen here?
I'm not sure that it is possible, based on the experts I consulted. It would have to be an excise tax, and the state has already delineated the excise taxes that, say, King County can levy. And then there would be constitutional issues under the Equal Protection Clause. And so I'm just not sure that we could legally pull it off. Now, provinces have powers that American states don't. But at the same time, this is also facing a legal challenge in Vancouver, and so it might not last.
If it were possible, would you be in favor of a foreign buyer tax?
I don't know where I would stand on it. I think that there's a whole bunch of taxes we need. We need a transaction tax on Wall Street. We need a carbon tax of some kind. Would a foreign buyer tax take some of the froth off this market? Maybe. Would it make us appear discriminatory and unwelcoming to foreign capital, which we need? Perhaps. So beyond that, I think that just beyond the legal issues, it does carry some risks. And something that's important to remember is the biggest reason that house prices are rising in the area, and especially the city and certain cities on the east side, is that there are a lot of new jobs, and many of those jobs pay well. And so this is a very fast-growing economy. This is not a speculative situation where you have a lot of empty subdivisions and a huge amount of money going into that. This is being driven by economic fundamentals. The question to ask ourselves going forward is whether it starts to really distort the market if a whole lot of foreign money starts to come in. We don't know the answer yet.
If not a tax to slow demand, what's a solution, assuming we wanted to keep a lid on prices? What would be a better way to do it?
Well, I don't know if there are solutions. I think there are intelligent responses, and you can build more. And by that, I do not mean take away the urban growth boundaries. We have plenty of places to build, and we're doing that to some degree. In addition to building more, what we need to do is have better transit that connects people in outlying areas that are affordable, even down to Tacoma, which is quite affordable, and get them to job centers and back with frequent transit.
Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Bill.
We're covering the news here today on KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The Seattle Police Department had such big plans. Body cameras for 850 officers by the end of this year. The first police department in America to do that. The Department of Justice put up some money for it. The city of Seattle budgeted money. The thinking was when cops wear body cameras, their interactions with people are more transparent, and that's good for everybody. So where are the body cameras? Journalist Mackenzie Funk investigated this for the New York Times Magazine. He says some big questions have brought the program to a halt, like who gets to see all that camera footage, and how do you protect the privacy of people who were filmed without their consent?
There was a Supreme Court decision here in the Washington State Supreme Court that said all police video, effectively, if it's not part of an active investigation, has to be released.
What's wrong with that? That's just more transparency.
Well, there are some logistical problems and there are some privacy issues. The logistics are Seattle, for instance, was sitting on 350 terabytes of video from its dash cam systems, millions of hours. And there are some privacy protections that were already written into the law, and you have to scrub the faces of minors in some cases, and victim of sexual assault in some cases. And so that meant that officers or staff would have to review every bit of that footage before releasing it. Think about if you've ever edited a video or an audio clip, you know how long that takes. It's actually mathematically impossible to release it all under those conditions. And so right at this moment that the world wants body cameras, here in Washington State, we have the realization that adding more footage will bankrupt police departments and bankrupt the city.
Again, this is not a dash cam from inside a car. With body cameras, we're talking about going into people's homes and right up in their faces.
Yeah, you see, people say, well, these records are all out there. It's all the same. You know, there's already dash cam. There's already surveillance cam. There are already, you know, police reports, so we can get access to those. What's the difference? And you don't have to really ask that if you've watched any of these videos. I mean, it is intimate. You're in the face of the victims or suspects or whomever the police officers are talking to. And it's important to think about who are these filming. Well, they're filming the public. They're strapped to, attached to the uniform of the officer or even to glasses they wear. They're seeing what the officer sees. So they're not looking at the police. They are looking at the people from the police's perspective. And when officers walk into homes, when they walk into hotels, when they're talking to someone on the street who could be an informant or a victim who doesn't want to be seen talking to the police, they are recording all of that, and they're recording it in high definition, and it's a close-up. It's very cinematic. It's not like these dash cam videos always. It's right there.
In fact, we've come to think of body cameras as saving the most vulnerable, or at least recording their abuse. And you pointed out in your piece that sometimes it's the most vulnerable feeling people who have a problem with body cameras.
Yeah, and I think it's an obvious point, but worth repeating that those communities that are already most policed and seeing the most police cars and most officers are de facto the ones that are going to be filmed and recorded more under these technologies. And here in Seattle, the first group to really say, hey, hold on a minute, let's really think about this, has been the Community Police Commission. And that was the group designated under the consent decree, under the federal reform effort.
This is the U.S. Justice Department forcing Seattle Police Department to reform.
That's right. It's a coalition that is supposed to speak for the people, actually speak for the community. And they were the first to raise an alarm. And it was because of the nature of the Public Records Act here and the nature of the footage that was soon quickly being released under these requests.
Mac, you've watched hours and hours and hours of this police body cam footage. What did you learn?
First of all, you see that, you know, policing is hard, and that a lot of the daily work of it is dealing with people in stressful situations and dealing appropriately with it, very humanely with it. And at the same time, what I saw, it was disturbing because I saw it on YouTube. I saw a man coming up to police officers and saying that his daughter, who he said was mentally disturbed, was hanging out with some very dangerous people and they needed to go run and save her. He gave her name. Eventually, you see the image of her. I saw a mother get pulled over for drunken driving. I know she's a mother because I found her on Facebook later. She freaked out. She started yelling and screaming and asking to call the babysitter because her kids were home alone. The one that really struck me was an interview with a young woman accused of prostitution in a hotel room somewhere in the state. And she tells her whole life story to the officer.
You know, and the officer tells her, oh, we can blur this even if it came out.
Yeah, and not, as I understand it, the officer was really unhappy when this thing appeared on YouTube and tried to get it taken down. It was more that he didn't know, as he wouldn't have, that a lawyer would determine that there was nothing that had to be redacted under this. And in fact, under the law, it had to be released. It wasn't discretionary. And so this officer, she asked, well, what about these cameras? And he says, well, the picture's pretty clear, but don't worry about it. If the media asks for it, we can blur it. And in fact, this is something I watched on YouTube, and I was able to track this woman down. And I've seen her house on Google Street View. I've seen her social media profiles. She's a person with a life who we would hope wouldn't always be defined by this. Please see us in our worst moments often. It's when you're having your worst day ever is often when you call a police officer. And this is what was showing up on YouTube.
So you have the difficulty in releasing this information to the public that we talked about. You have people, vulnerable people, saying, we don't want to be constantly on police cameras aimed at us. You have the question of when do these things get turned off and on?
You know, there's a moral case, especially after Ferguson, for body cameras. And it's been very clear. And that's that after a study in Rialto, California, it showed that complaints against officers, which could be a proxy for misconduct, went way down when they wore body cameras. And it showed also that use of force by officers went way down when they wore body cameras. And that, armed with the fact that we'll finally know what's going on, I mean, that is a powerful moral argument for having these things.
You call it the self-awareness effect?
That's right. Well, I don't call it. The researchers who are from Cambridge called it that. And it was the idea that these officers, when they're wearing the cameras, would walk up to people and say, by the way, you should know that we're recording. It was a courtesy. But that courtesy was something more. It let both parties sort of sense that they were in this panopticon, really, that they're both being watched and that they should be on their best behavior. And that the Cambridge study surmised that was what was going on. Because everyone realized they were on camera, they were better behaved. And that makes sense, right? It's intuitive. Well, that was the pre-Ferguson case. In fact, it was touted by Taser, which is one of the biggest manufacturers of body cameras, the biggest, in a press release even before it came out in a journal. And it's turned out to have been undermined by later research by these same Cambridge people.
Mac, after all you reported on this and found out about pros and cons of body cams, Do you think Seattle's right to pursue body cameras for police officers?
After all of this, I am still as confused as anyone. And what it comes down to for me is the cost. Right now, it's $1.8 million, I believe, is going to be spent on body cameras. And my big question is, because the science itself behind body cameras is so new, because we're, in fact, running this experiment now, because we know that these things can be released, for all those reasons, is this the best use of $1.8 million when also Seattle PD is making substantial progress under the consent decree, doing things that are a lot less sexy? Trainings, new protocols, investigations of use of force when there is force, better reporting, you know, the little things that make a police department better, a cultural change. I question really the amount of money thrown at a tech fix and that it's going to these big contractors like Taser more than I question, of course, the reason why everyone would want them. I am not against body cameras at all if they can be made to work, but I have seen very few cases nationally or here where we've got it right. And so I guess I'm saying got it right in terms of policy. What should be retained? Who should be able to see it? How should they be able to see it? These are complex problems, and they're being worked out right now. There is a new state law that came in to effect in June. It was sponsored by a legislator in Bainbridge Island named Drew Hansen. And it does a lot of protections. It sunsets in 3 years. But
privacy
protections of body cameras. And it gives us some space to work out these issues. So a task force is hammering through all of this now. And so why the rush is my question.
Do you see a world where less and less privacy means we're less and less embarrassed about broadcasting our true selves?
Yeah. I mean, it's already happening. And This is an argument. In fact, I didn't make it into the story I wrote, but I did talk to Bruce Harrell in his office at City Council, and he said, well, think about that. I mean, if I walk to a restaurant down the block, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 cameras are going to have a picture of me as I go. Our expectations of privacy have shifted. And I understand that. In fact, the reason a lot of these things were that the country is getting mad about, and understandably so, all the shootings of young men all across the country, young black men, it's because there is so much video out there. But I would point out is that most of that video to date has been shot by citizens and not by police. And the balance of power and who can access that is immensely different. And the power of the state to record all this and then share it with others, that's a different thing than the sense that you're putting something up voluntarily on Twitter and Facebook. It's part of the same trend, but I do think that we're getting to a point where it's not, you know, what we put out there, but how it's compiled and who holds this stuff.
Seattle-based journalist Mackenzie Funk wrote that piece for the New York Times Magazine. It's called, Should We See Everything a Cop Sees? I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in to The Record. I hope you'll get our podcast, The Record, The Week in Review, and more at KUOW.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.